Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome along to our Life and Times programme here at Midlands 103. And in today's programme, I'm delighted to welcome in a man who I've seen in action, let me put it like that. A guy who's got a very, very quick brain. I'm almost in a little bit nervous in having him here because I've seen him. He has no respect for anybody. Neil Delamere, you're very welcome.
How are you? That's a great introduction.
I did.
No respect for anybody. And I do. It just depends on what they've done.
Well, I suppose before we get into it, I did see in action. I was at the Gateway, the famous Gateway Chamber. Well, in fairness, to say you were a little bit antagonised. You were very, I thought, gosh, this is not the Neil Delamere I've heard about. Like, you were very professional and slick and introducing and all of that.
Yeah.
And then a certain individual got up and proceeded to have a go off you.
Well, you see, what happened was, if people don't know, it's actually been on shows and it made me a load of money. It was on DVDs and everything. It was Midlands Gateway Awards,
Yes,
Michael Leary was
first ambassador.
It was, yes. He was a keynote speaker and everybody was there to see him. And I don't think the organisers would mind me saying that it was a very, very long room and a lot of people there.
Over 1,000 people in the room.
Yeah, and it was not necessarily ideal in terms of sound and stuff like this. So it was you kind of had to get through and just kind of marshal the troops and just give out all the awards and all the rest. So, but when I was introducing him, I knew that it would be, their attention would definitely be focused and they'd be quieting down and all the rest for that. So that was when I had a few digs at him, messing with him, right? But I knew the personality that Michael had. I say Michael as if I know the man, but you know yourself, you get some sort of instinct from all the TV appearances.
They brought out a book of
and all the radio appearances.
They brought out a book, of his quotes.
Yeah, so, but I knew that if I threw a couple of messes in with him, he would come back.
He'd rise.
But I also knew that I was on after him again. So I knew I had the last word.
Plus it's Ryanair, so you've loads of information.
Yeah, you have a few gags. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I had a pop off him and he walked right into it and had a pop back and it was great fun. And then I got up again and finished it off. And he actually, at the end, he leaned in and went, "It's great to go last, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, it is."
Well, in fairness, I think he got all the rest of us back because it was debt by PowerPoint on the night and he proceeded to bore the shite out of us with 5% on this, that and the other.
He took it in good stead. Yeah.
Well, in fairness, he's well got. He's living in this franchise, so I have to be very careful. At the end of the day, he can just turn around, wake up, smile in the morning, and go back to sleep.
Yeah,
if he wants.
I'm sure his half a billion euro probably insulates himself from having a slag on
one of the quotes I saw in one of the things was that he was asked, "Do rich people travel on Ryanair?" And he turns around and he says, "I travel on Ryanair all the time, and I'm very rich."
Yeah, yeah. You got to kind of admire that to be to a certain extent.
Neil, you're an Offaly man.
Yes, I am. Edenderry, yeah.
Edenderry. And not that long ago, neither.
No. I suppose I'm out now a few years. But,
out.
out, gone, left. I went to university, so
right.
There was no universities in Edenderry, and so I had to go.
Who are the Delamere's? Where did Delamere come from?
Delamere, of the sea. It's a Norman name, yeah.
Sounds like something. It does actually sound like something you'd order in a French restaurant.
Free the mare are sweets, or not sweets, they're seafood, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, Norman, I'm told that we founded the Abbey at Multifarm.
Fair
and
bit,
we're
yeah.
very, very astute family. I don't think so. I'd imagine we raped and pillaged like everybody else and given a bit of land.
At least you weren't
return.
Like the Fitzgeralds. Like, I mean, we got it our ways. We used to rape their cattle and stampede their or something like that.
Stampede their women and rape their cattle.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. You have that look about you don't mind me saying.
Nice.
But I think we came in then and I haven't really researched the family tree. I'd love to do it. I would love to do that show. You know, who do you think you are? I would love to do that.
Would you?
Mainly because it's got one of the finest named people I've ever heard. The historian who usually does the genealogy of people is called Turtle Bunbury, which is an exceptional
it's
name.
It's wonderful.
Turtle Bunbury is right up there with Pookie Quesnel, who was once in an episode of The Clinic. I collect these names. I used to have to watch various bits of television for Republic of Telly, so you
I'd watch
stuff like that, you know, and kind of those names jump out at you. But I would love to do that and find more about the kind of
I'd be scared now. They'd probably in some mud hut up the Galty Mountains or stuff like that and say this is where you come from.
But what would be wrong with that?
But it wouldn't have to go back very far.
No, that was last week. You're in negative equity on the same hut now.
I would imagine so. Tell us about the family itself. Your mum and dad, are they from Edenderry?
No, we ended up in Edenderry for one simple reason. It's because my father worked for Bowden Mona and it was midway between any of the several installations that he could have worked on. You know he could have worked in.
What's your dad's name?
Derry Green John.
What's he like?
He's great. Yeah, he's brilliant.
I heard you're a bit of a chip off the old block, are you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's, I suppose that's for other people to decide, you know.
Well, he's supposed to be fairly quick himself.
He is. He's good crack, yeah, and he loves a laugh and a joke. And I think people have said that before, all right, yeah. And so that's where we kind of ended up there. I could have been from... I suppose there was Littleton and then there was Derry Green and all the rest.
Well, you didn't want to go on
Littleton. And Crohan. So, kind of Edenderry was, you know, an hour and a bit.
What was it like growing up in Edenderry?
It was great, yeah. I mean, I think it's... I think towns... I think rural life to a certain extent, maybe not necessarily Edenderry, but I certainly think... If you land right in certain towns in Ireland, it's the best quality of life in Ireland, full stop. You know, because people know each other and are really reasonably supportive of one another. The education system seems to be good. There isn't the same massive differences between the haves and the have-nots. I think outside a city, like, you know, I don't think there'd be the same inequalities. And
or do people take notice of it as much?
Maybe they don't, or maybe we were sheltered. I don't know, but I loved living there.
Is there many in the family?
Yeah, there's four of us. Yeah, and all my brothers and sisters. Obviously, we all went to the same school. We all went to Edenderry St Mary Secondary School.
Are they still in Edenderry?
No, they left to pursue further studies. So there's no third level education. At a university level in Edenderry, so that's what.
So you went to school in Edenderry?
And so school in Edenderry, yeah.
What were you like as a student?
I was a good student,
right.
I would say, I think. Kind of an academic family, so we'd be good enough at school.
What was your profession?
We used to take the piss at the teachers all the time,
okay.
I would. But you'd know when to stop. Because I always thought there was no point in going any further to get the attention.
See, get the laugh. There's another difference.
I wouldn't know when to stop.
Because yeah. I would be the one, like Christian Brothers, the letter comes out, or yeah. I would spend a lot of time in my own private classroom in the corridor.
Really? Your own private classroom?
Yes.
So one-on-one education.
Well, actually, I learned...
Free grinds
I learned,
is what
I learned
that was.
The spoof one time. We had two particular Christian Brothers who were vicious
yeah.
at the time. I'm sorry. And one of them put me outside the door and he was going to deal with me later. And when yeah. I was out there, the other guy came down.
Really?
Yeah. So I started playing them off between each other and I think I escaped that time.
Well, I wouldn't have even ended up in the corridor.
No, you wouldn't have.
You just make them laugh. If you make the class laugh and have a bit of crack with them and you look at the teacher and if you get them laughing despite themselves, that was always a bit of crack. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I kind of did the work as well. So.
You're a guy who thinks on his feet and you're a guy who kind of looks at life. You have to look at life a slight little bit differently from the rest of us.
Yeah.
You do.
Well, my instinct usually is to go, when everybody's saying one thing, I always go, why are they all saying that?
Yeah.
And it makes me kind of think maybe that's not necessarily the best.
When did this become evident?
Like,
were you always a bit of crack as a young flower?
I don't know. I'm professionally a bit of crack. I'm really grumpy off stage. No, I'm not. I don't know where it came from. Like you said, my dad loves a laugh and a joke and is always telling the stories and all the rest. And it was only when my brother-in-law kind of was introduced into the family that we really realised, oh, these stories are really good. It's just that we've heard them so many times.
So he provided the audience.
You'd see other people kind of liking them. So it probably comes from that. But I had no intention of doing this as a career. None whatsoever.
Because, I mean, it's like when somebody says to me, what used to do before this? I said, this was my job. What was your job?
I was a software engineer.
That's pretty impressive in terms
of... Not really.
No, it sounds good. Software engineer, you know, obviously good with numbers and...
Not really. I just kind of left and did... I did the same courses that my brother had done, and only because I knew it would get a job. It was kind of the dot-com boom at the time when I was in college, and it was a stopgap measure.
Software engineers design software, wrote loads of code, you know.
Yeah, we wrote loads of code, all right, but I only did it for... I didn't do it for that long, like a year and a bit. I wasn't that interested in it, to be honest. But I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do, but I didn't know what I did want to do. And I thought, I considered medicine and I considered pharmacy and I considered law and all that stuff, but I always thought that they, particularly medicine, would be really a vocation. And you didn't want to do that for 6 or 7 years as a stopgap. Whereas you could do arts as a stopgap, or you could do...
What degree did
computer.
You take?
I did computer applications in DCU, yeah.
Okay.
I could have done whatever I wanted, pretty much.
3 years?
4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
A degree.
Yeah, a degree. So... I just kind of, but then when I was in there and I was looking around for what I wanted to do, really, I was always very interested in stand-up and then kind of started to do it.
Did you do any amateur stand-up before?
No. We had musicals in school and I was too shy to do them. I wouldn't have done
them.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have done them at all. We had a musical in, I think we did Grease in fifth fifth or sixth year, and I wouldn't have done it, no way.
But surely of all the things to do on stage, being a comedian is the most risky.
Yeah,
well, you've nowhere to hide.
You sounded like you had a list of things there.
Well, the most risky. Well, it is the most risky in terms of, like, if you go out, you can sing a song. You know, the song is 3.5 minutes. You're out of there. If you go out there and you start dying from the first,
it'll be 3.5 minutes as well. To be honest with you, even if there's an hour left, when you move away, and particularly in the age anyway, like even if you stayed where you're from, but even when you move away, in particular, and you move to a city, you change to a certain extent. And particularly for a young lad between kind of 17 or 18 and 22, you change immeasurably, you know, and you actually begin to mature when all your friends, all the girls, they've all matured at that stage and you're still a tool. So I suppose the person who did stand up at 21 or 22 was considerably different to the teenager who wouldn't have done the music.
Describe your first stand up then. Is this where you'd rehearse it to this
and will you stop?
Every word
knew it backwards, sideways. That place could have been run over. The place could have been knocked down, blown up by the IRA, and I would have finished the set. I knew it backwards.
How long is a typical set?
Well, at that stage, you would do 5 minutes. So basically, you would go to the International Comedy Club, which is in Dublin, in Wicklow Street, and it's a tiny room. It's the size of the studio, maybe the size of this, like this room we're in now, maybe twice or three times that.
Very not a lot.
No mics, you know. So you know, maybe 50 feet to the back of the room, no microphones, and that's where Ardal Hanlon started. That's where Dylan Moran started. That's where everybody who you would know in stand-up started there. And I used to go there, and eventually I just went, I'd like to try a few minutes. Try 5 minutes.
When did you try?
And I went up, and I did 5 minutes, and I have no idea how it went because I blocked it out of my memory. But it must have gone okay, because I said, can I do another few minutes? And then you do another few minutes, and you build up slowly and surely. I've always been slightly jealous of the lads from London, because we used to do, and all the Irish comics will tell you this, you would do a gig, and then the next gig you would get would be a month away or 6 weeks away or whatever. And then if you really hustled,
you wouldn't have had many venues, of course.
No,
wouldn't you?
No. So if you really hustled, you might have gotten 40 gigs in a year or something like that. So the London lads, when you'd meet them a couple of years down the line, and they would have done 40 gigs in their first 6 weeks, kind of. So they would have their advantage was they would have a more time, but their disadvantage would be that I think it's personal opinion, that I think some Irish acts develop in a different way than the London acts, because it's really harsh over there in a lot of their clubs. Like, get to it, show no kind of
is there a difference
almost more
between
cynical.
Like, I mean, you're one of the best known of the younger generation comedians in Ireland.
Yeah.
And you've a lot of strings to your bow. You can perform on TV, you can act, you can do all that kind of stuff.
Can't really act.
You're doing a pretty good job at the moment.
Acting like a normal human being. I have an acting story for you.
Do you?
Yes. Do you know Pure Mule? I said this on the panel once.
Yes.
Pure Mule, which is
Eden Dairy Connections,
written by an Eden Dairy man, good friends of my brother, and about Eden Dairy essentially, or a veiled Eden Dairy, filmed in Manor. And it was a few years ago, the first time it was on television, and one of the parts was for Scobie, which was, I think, was a 25, 26 year old fella from the Midlands with a Midlands accent who was a bit cheeky and all the rest. So I can't act, but my agent said to me, you should go for that. And I essentially tried out for part, playing myself, and didn't get it. Did not get it. That's how bad an actor I am.
Okay. I'm going to take a commercial break.
Go for it.
Life and Times of Midlands 103. It's Neil Delamere. We'll be right back in 2 minutes' time. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times. It's Neil Delamere. Neil, so the acting, you didn't go with the acting.
No. I think the acting didn't go with me somehow.
Okay. So when was your kind of first big break? Because, I mean, you're what age are you?
32.
You're a young guy.
The panel.
How did you get on the panel?
I don't know. No, I have a fair idea. 2004 was really the big year. 2004 was the first year I did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Now, it took a couple of years to go back to it, but I toured in Australia as a part of an Irish kind of compilation show, and I did Just for Laughs in Montreal. I got to Montreal, and Just for Laughs was filmed. So I suppose the producer of the panel was always looking for people knocking around Ireland, and would have seen a few minutes of the stuff from Montreal and kind of just gave me a shot at it, you know. And I got very lucky with the panel. Like, if you consider, it just kind of suited me, or people thought it suited me anyway.
Oh, you're a natural on it.
From the start.
There's a lovely balance of satire. There's so many balanced
and
satire
personalities as well, which
you
is very lucky.
Each other really, really well.
But like, if you consider that, like, in the lineup, the steady lineup of the panel, I suppose now or even the past few years, you had Dara hosting the thing. Now he's left since 2007.
Yes.
So Dara was, and he's kind of very urbane and very sophisticated man. I would say, and very charming. And he'd be, you know, kind of the daddy in the middle. And then you had Maxwell, who's the kind of the Northside Dublin scamp, shall we say, with various references and allusions to maybe nefarious activities. Then you had the grumpy northerner, Colin Murphy.
Yeah.
And then, sure, what do you need then is maybe you need somebody maybe slightly younger, ideally, and someone who's from the country.
Yes.
And so, in many ways, we kind of had covered all the bases.
Right.
And so we were very lucky to do that. And I was also very lucky that, you say, a good friend of mine said it would be PJ Gallagher, who would be very well known from being brilliant, absolutely brilliant on Naked Camera. But PJ wouldn't necessarily want to do something like the panel. And yet he can tour all around Ireland on the basis of his brilliant characters. Whereas I would never have done Naked Camera. I just wouldn't be any good at what he did, what he had a singular talent for. So sometimes you're just lucky to what you fall into, really.
But I mean, that's taken off for you, because I mean, you're a staple part of that. I mean, it wouldn't be the panel without you in it.
Well, hopefully not.
But it wouldn't.
But how much of that was the break?
Is it rehearsed or is it, you know? Well,
no, it's not rehearsed.
Rough idea of what's
it's not rehearsed. And people, it kind of annoys us when people say it is rehearsed. And usually people, you know, somebody in a paper or something will say, oh, it's rehearsed. It's not. What will happen is it will, I mean, this week, for example, if we were doing the panel this Wednesday, you know that you're going to be talking about the election because it's the biggest story around. So what would happen is you would, You would know the certain amount of stories. So we go, oh, listen, we're going to have the kind of, well, let's talk about these 14 or 15 stories, right? That's what we know. That's all we know.
So you'd probably have a little gag for that.
Yeah, so we don't know. I don't know what Maxwell's going to say about it. I don't know what Colin Murphy's going to say about it. And they don't know what I'm going to say about it. And then if you watch the show, a particularly very good show, it just starts somewhere and then goes all around the world. And then you have to keep going. So the idea that it's rehearsed and spontaneous isn't true because...
Where is it filmed?
It's filmed in various different theatres around Dublin.
Right.
And yeah, like, which is very important, actually. A very important part of it. People might not even realise that. But if you go into a studio doesn't... A theatre is built for live performance. And a studio is built for television, obviously. And a studio... proximity to the performer is really, really important in all stand-up. People might not realise this if they don't go to a lot of stand-up, but that's why in a studio they're a little bit further away from you. Sometimes if you watch a TV show, you get that feeling that the audience is a little bit distant from what's going on, because it is, because there's cameras in between and they need a certain
barrier,
amount.
Yes.
They need manoeuvrability and all the rest, whereas theatres are not like that.
Is there much of a live audience then?
Oh yeah, they'd be kind of... You know, and depending on the capacity of the audiences, we play 300, 400, you know.
So when does it start then? Say, you know, you're recording a Wednesday.
Yeah.
What's your routine?
On a Wednesday, we would go in about kind of 2:30 and we would have that discussion of, okay, what do you want to talk about? Oh, well, this week we have to talk about Libya. Okay, right. Okay, after Libya, what we talk about? Well, we have to talk about the election. And then after that, what we talk about? Oh, I don't know. We might set up that political party we've been talking about. And so that takes a while. But that's it. I can't stress that enough. Nobody's going to say, okay, then I do that line and then you do that line and then he does that line. That doesn't happen.
It would look naff anyway.
You would realise it. And also, we've already established I'm not that good an actor. So when you see me laughing at something that Maxwell says or Murphy says, it's real, you know?
But, okay, the other part of it then, going out on stage, how do you become instantly warm? You know, I mean, like, comfortable.
Warm.
Sorry.
Do you want me to finish the rest of the panel day first, or do you want to go back to the other one?
Go ahead.
Happens after that. Interesting. We go and we have we get makeup done, and we have a rehearsal, and the rehearsal consists of a sound check because we don't rehearse, as we've established. And then we start at 8:00, and that's it. So one of us will go out and do the warm up for us, talk to the audience. There's no warm up band, so one of us we draw lots every year, and whoever loses, or every week whoever loses goes out and does it, and then we introduce the show.
The
and starts at 8:00.
Yeah, the program itself is like it's a 30-minute program. How long does it take to record?
No, it's a bit longer now. It's kind of you're probably thinking that we did one very short show this year because of, I think there was an election special or something like that, but normally it would be about 3/4 of an hour.
No, fair enough. It's always on in my house. My wife Siobhan loves it.
Yeah, good. She's the one.
She loves it.
She's the woman. But it takes about 1.5-2 hours.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's
all.
That
seems remarkable. Like, not a lot of time.
You want to see the stuff we cut out?
I could imagine.
It was live. at the very beginning, before I joined in 2003.
Right.
Which I would imagine would be much more nerve-wracking again.
Take away the safety.
Terrifying, yeah.
But that goes back to my other question. I mean, you know...
How do I warm up?
Yeah. Well, sorry, how do you become warm? How do you become receptive to like other guys' jokes and stuff like that in that kind of environment?
Well, it's just exciting because, like, a live audience, we're all old hands, really, you know, and we've all... If you ask most stand-ups, would they prefer television or stand-up, they'll say stand-up. It's our first love. And it's also the stuff that we're all a bit kind of megalomaniacal. We're all megalomaniacs, I'll say it that way.
So,
because if you think of a stand-up, we can control everything. You control how long you stay on stage, what you talk about. You know, you choreograph it, you write it, you produce it. Everything is yours. So when you're doing... So that's our first love. And when you do... television, you know, you have various other things, people editing and people directing, and a collective like the panel, you have to go, okay, you have to step back and all the rest. So it's exciting. If you put an audience in a room, that plays up to our immediate, oh, we're on stage now, so we're kind of instantly warm, I suppose, you know, and we feed off them and they feed off us.
And in terms of you feed off each other then as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Irish comedy as a whole, like it's really... It seems to have progressed in the last number of years to a reasonable level, because before it was all the same old McGinty went to and Murphy went to this, and you know, the Brendan Grace, the non-offensive sort of stuff. And
I suppose it's developed in the way the country had developed there for a while, you know, that we were kind of very confident and very, very self-aware and not insular anymore. We were looking around the world again, and I suppose it kind of reflected that. It'd be interesting to see what'll happen in the next few years, now that we've kind of a bit more...
It looks like when the rubber bandits part out there, you know, like a horse outside. It was kind of that commitments moment when we got our sense of humour back again. And
yeah, it was very good. It was zeitgeist. It was off the moment.
It came from a programme that you were associated with as well.
Yeah, they were brought in... I did it for two series. Mm. And then this year, and somebody asked me about this recently, somebody said to me, so why did you leave? And I said, it was very simple why I left. I essentially came down to a choice between the panel, which I've done for years and years and years, which has given me everything that I have, really, and the ability to tour, and that people will come and see me, which I'm very grateful for, and something that I had just started. And more specifically, panel is a much bigger audience because it's an RT1. It's much closer to stand-up because you're winging it and you're being yourself, almost. But kind of one of the most important things was that there were so many of the Republic of Tellys last year. Like, I did, between the pilots and then I do a show for the North called The Blame Game, I had television contracts from kind of September to July, which means I couldn't do Melbourne last year, the comedy festivals in the Southern Hemisphere, and I couldn't do Edinburgh last year. And I've done Edinburgh for 3 years in a row, and I was kind of going, there's something has to give if I want to do a live tour and a DVD and the panel and the Republic of Telly. So it's just... one of these things has to drop out.
You were talking earlier on about your inability to act. However, like, here you are in more or less a different format, a much more straighter format, being the front man for the Republic of Telly.
Yeah, but it's stuff that, particularly in the second series, when we actually got time and there's no panel, a lot of it was written by me with other lads. So it was, you're not acting because you're using your own words.
But you were kind of, in fairness, again, it was a programme I particularly enjoyed as well. I particularly enjoyed it when you were doing it.
Mm. But it's the right thing to say.
but it was effortless in terms of you were sedgwaying into stuff, and you were just a natural at doing it.
But like, to be honest with you, you're just reading a screen. Is
there a teleprompter in front of you, like with the stuff on it?
For that?
Yeah.
Yes, for that thing,
okay.
The idea that, because then you'd have to learn off the script altogether, you know?
Work.
The idea that, you know, you hear some television presenters saying that it's hard. It's not hard. They'll tell you it's hard. It's not hard. You're reading something in front of you. Can you read and sound reasonably natural? Yeah, that's it. You know, unless something is very difficult, like, you know, like somebody like John Bowman or Pat Kenny when they're doing political stuff, I mean, they're exceptional and they're brilliant. And you know, Pat Kenny isn't reading an auto.
Well, I think it's the ability to be able to think while you've got somebody saying stuff into your ear and talking at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's very admirable.
Say, on Frontline, he's marshalling various people and doing various things like that. That's a talent. But the lads, you know, maybe kind of pop presenters reading the next. Mm. This is the next thing on this by, you know.
You're up there in the league of, you know, Darrow Breen and all of these. You seem to travel very well. I mean, your comedy travels very well. It transfers. You were mentioning places earlier on, like Canada, like Australia.
Mm.
your type of humour, the humour that she push, travels well and is receptive by those people.
By the way, if I am in the same league as Dara, Dara would be Arsenal and I'd be West Ham. I'm hanging on around at the bottom.
He's significantly older than you.
He is significantly older. I was actually texting him last night about that. But no, in that he's playing to a much bigger market and all the rest.
But he's in the UK now.
He's
doing boat trips and he's hanging out with
He's doing 40 Vicar Streets a year. He is a big act. He's a very nice man. I actually have a lot of time for him, obviously, because he was involved in the first kind of break. In terms of internationally, I've gigged all over the place. The great thing about being Irish is that, one, we've no historical grudges with anybody, really. They have no historical grudges with us, I should say. And secondly, as we speak English, there's expats all over the world. Mm. So I've played to British expats or Irish expats everywhere. And also, people will go and see an Irish package show everywhere as well.
Okay. When was the defining moment when you say, there's a career in this?
It hasn't happened yet. There was a kind of...
I have to say, you pulled into this radio station a nice little sexy motor.
That I just stole in Dangan.
Yeah, right.
I drove my own car to Ballinagar and then changed. I remember sitting down when I was doing software engineering, and I sat down in a cafe on Manor Street in Dublin, Stony Batter, and I was talking to my friend who'd been at my first gig, and I said, if I could earn half the money I earn in stand-up as I do doing this software engineering job, I would give it up. And then I gave it up, and I only intended to do this for a few months and kind of get it out of my system and all the rest. And I had a few quid saved because I won a competition, and I had a few quid saved, and I thought, listen, once I work through that, I'll go back and I'll do a real job and I'll be a proper grown up. And it hasn't happened yet. So,
well, we need to take another short commercial break, but I do want to talk about the international dimension to it, because, I mean, outside of going to places like Edinburgh you're dropping names like Montreal and, it's very exotic to a lad who's hardly been out of the country. Life and Times, Neil Delamere. We'll be right back. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times and it's Neil Delamere. Neil, I was going to ask you at this stage, what's it like getting up in Montreal? They're very exotic sounding places.
Somebody asked me what Montreal was like, I said it's an awful lot like the inside of a van and the inside of a hotel, because that's what we were doing when we did Just for Laughs. I presented Just for Laughs after Ed Byrne did, because he became the gala host over there, which is a really prestigious job. And the first year was so difficult, like you literally didn't see anything of the whole city at all. And then the next year we saw a bit more.
Would you not have like sort of or?
It was a very, very, very tight schedule. I suppose you could have stayed on at the end, but at that stage all the comics were going home and you wouldn't know anybody, so you were just kind of fairly hardcore pressed to it. The next year we did it was good. We got to see a bit more of it and got to see Segway go right around on a Segway around down by the docks and stuff. So, but other places I've been to have been very lucky, and you would have only a few gigs and you get to see the place.
Australia? So you wouldn't travel down there just for one gig?
No. Australia was there for a run. I've been there a couple of times, and I particularly like going to places that not only would you not have been before. I mean, I could have done this with computers, but you hang out with people who maybe would know scenes that you don't know about. You know, it's like I've been to Finland. We used to go to Finland every year for 3 or 4 years for this bizarre festival in the middle of nowhere. Me and various other Irish comics would go out there, but you get to hang around with the Finnish comics, and they would just show you a world that you're going to, I'd never have.
How could you understand them?
Well, how could they understand me? Their English is so good, it's incredible. Like, you know, somebody speaking English, but English in an awfully accent in the middle of Helsinki, and they all got it. When I was leaving, a friend of mine called Andre Wikström is a very big Finnish comic, right? And I did his gig one day. It's one of the best gigs in the world. It's amazing.
What did they laugh at?
In Helsinki. I thought I had done Denmark, and Danes will laugh at anything. Like, you can be cruel and they're very liberal and all the rest. And I did Finland. Now, I know it's close enough geographically, and I thought maybe it would be similar. No, not similar at all. Finn's very reserved, very strange, kind of. But I did a gig in Helsinki once with Andre. And Andre's a good-looking fella, kind of a metrosexual, has his own clothing label, all that sort of stuff, right? So girls love him. So there's 200 Finnish girls at this gig, and they're gorgeous, like genuinely stunning. So the gig is great for whatever way, and it was really good fun and all the rest. And at the end of the gig, this Finnish girl comes to me, and she's amazing looking. Like, I'm getting flashbacks to the Harriers in Tullamore when I was 15. Right? And she comes up and she goes, she just looks at me and she goes, talk to me. like this, right? I'm going, no better, man, right? So I'm talking to her for a while, and all the other lovely Finnish ladies leaving the venue, and I don't mind because I'm talking to the nicest looking girl in the place. So then Andrew goes, come on, we'll go to this nightclub. And I said, yeah, we'll go to the nightclub. Yeah. And I said to the girl, would you like to go to the nightclub? And she goes, no, no, that is enough practicing my English for now. I walked away. So me and Andrew just drinking pints in the, on our own.
How do you pull in Finnish, huh?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, you're a single guy.
Yeah.
No sign of getting tied down yet. Enjoying yourself.
Couldn't possibly divulge information like that.
Okay, you plead the fifth on that.
I'm not married.
The business of the business end of it. I mean, here you are, you're touring and so forth. You must have like an organisation behind you too. Or do you do it yourself?
Well, no, you have an agent. You have an agent, and you have for a tour, you get somebody to do the publicity and stuff like that, just to.
But how conscious of you? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, business is business. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to live and drive swanky cars and whatever else. How conscious of you are you of that? Is there a plan in place for that? Is you don't.
What do you mean? She's a guard, wouldn't ask me these questions.
Well, no, fair, but you say Neil Delamere is the brand.
Yes.
How conscious are you of the brand? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, do you look 5 years down the line? Or
plans and projections and all that, like a business plan? No,
in terms of Neil Delamere himself, are you looking like, you know, where you want to be when you're 37?
Well, I suppose everybody does that to a certain extent. You know, where do you want to live and who do you want to be with and, you know, that sort of stuff. But no, there's no serious... Because it's a kind of a nebulous thing, really, this. It's you're either...
Hot or you're not.
Well, to a certain extent... Well, I wouldn't go that far, but people are fickle and there's always something new. A lot of
how conscious of you are? You know, you're very much in flavour and deservedly so. I mean, you've brought laughter to so many things. But how conscious of you like that? You know, maybe... It might get a bit cooler.
Well, I think it's always going to. Everybody in every career in this kind of industry has periods of being bigger, shall we say, than not. You know, you might do...
But is that back to your material?
Six Vicar Streets, and then you might do four Vicar Streets next year. But is it back to your material? It's back to... myriad factors, really. I mean, your material... She could be arresting, if you could be writing the best material in the world, and if nobody knows who you are... They won't know it's the best material in the world because they won't go and see it. So, I mean, exposure is a big thing as well. In Ireland, what has become very obvious over, even when I started and before television or anything, was versatility is very, very, very important. A friend of mine years ago, I was travelling a lot to the UK because there was no gigs here. And he said, if you want to stay at home in Ireland more, learn how to MC. So you learn how to MC a gig. And if you MC a gig, a lot of the time you don't need to use any jokes or anything, because if you're any good off the top of your head, you can just banter, you know? So that was a key thing.
You do a fair bit of that, though, don't you?
You do, because it makes every gig individual and spontaneous and it's a bit of crack, and you get bizarre stuff out of it as well. There's always somebody who has something weird, somebody cleaning lighthouses.
Would you be more nervous of MCing a gig as opposed to doing a comedy gig?
No, because you can do whatever you want. You do the banter if the banter is working. And if the banter doesn't work, you can just go, well, I'll just do a really good joke that I have. Well, you hope you have a really good joke. So, but you need to be versatile in this country, and you need to be able to do television, you need to be able to MC gigs, you need to be able to tour.
Actually, you're pretty good on radio, because I've heard you know,
I presented Ray Darcy's show,
and
the MC show.
How did you find that?
That was fun, yeah, I enjoyed that.
There you're just looking at screens and...
Yeah, but the production team is very good, and they kind of mind you, you know, a little bit. And what was a little weird on it was that you couldn't not give of your life. He's on for 3 hours every day for 5 days a week. I think it would be very difficult to be in his position, in Ray Darcy's position, and not give of your life.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, they say that in your radio training programs around the place. You know, that if you know, if I could tell about your kids, tell about your life, tell about this, and make it touchy feely and relevant to the listener.
Yeah. Whereas if on stand up, you can give exactly as much or as little as you want.
As in go into character. And
you could write an entire show that's based entirely on a character, and we'd never know anything about.
Do you find that people sometimes would have unreasonable expectations of you? I know that like you're in the public domain, and you know. You might get people coming up to you in restaurants and stuff like that, but they expect you to be funny all the time.
No. I mean, I think people are familiar with the whole thing enough now to know that you're on or you're off, you know. And people are very pleasant, you know. I suppose the key to that is if they don't like what you do, they won't say anything at all, you know. And they'll keep it to themselves, or they'll have a go at you on the internet.
You've a fairly recognisable face. Like, do people generally, would they come up to you when they're out? And I'm sure they'd be quite respectful and say hi, you need to come my photograph with you.
Yeah, they'd say hello.
How do you handle fame?
they'd say hello and they'd take a picture or something like that, I suppose, you know. But they're all, or the vast majority of them, are very undemanding. And they see, the thing about a photograph is that it has a very defined end point. So they go, come up and say, can I get a photograph? And you go, of course. And they take a picture and then they go, thank you very much. And they go away. And I've never had any trouble.
So what about going out socially? No, you know.
You asking me out? Is that what this is about?
But going out socially and stuff like that. Yeah. No, like people no give issues. You space.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I don't think I'm as well known as you think I am, maybe, you know. I think if you were proper well known, you might get a bit of, you know.
I used to be fairly friendly with Joe Lynch years and years ago. And Joe's come down to Cork and stay off in my place and stuff, but you couldn't go outside the bloody door.
Dinny,
yeah.
Ah, but I mean, he's an institution. I'm a man who talks rubbish in a darkened room. Friday and Saturday night. That man is an institution, you know.
The gigs themselves, do you gig often?
I do, yeah. I mean, I've been on tour now from September till probably May, you know. So I don't know how many gigs that'll be, and then you do the panel in between it. And
you're back up here in the Midlands now fairly shortly. Next week,
I'm doing the Mullingar Arts Centre on Thursday, the 10th of March, which is a bit strange.
Next Thursday,
yeah, because I was talking to my dad about it, and he went, "I met your mother there." So they met.
Where's your mum from, by the way?
She's from Dublin. Oh, but they met in the county hall in Mullingar to dance. And several years ago, shall we say in the 1960s, that's all I'm allowed to say,
right?
Because it will date them. And so now, that however many years later, I'm playing a gig there. It's kind of going to be a bit strange.
Is this your first time doing a gig in Mullingar?
No, I did one. I've done gigs in Mullingar. I've done gigs in the stables in Mullingar, and I've done the Art Centre before, so
it's a fabulous facility. Yeah. The Art Centre.
Sure, enough cousins. The cousins will be there. There's a rake of cousins that'll come along to it.
But in terms of a gig, your gigs probably start at what, 8 o'clock?
Yeah.
How long are they on for?
I'll get a warm up act, the sport act on, and he'll do about kind of half an hour, and then we'll have a break, and I'll probably do kind of an hour and 20, an
so
hour
you,
and
you
a half.
So you'll kind of pull up in front of the door at 5 to 8 and stroll in.
Pretty
and go,
much.
I'm here.
Pretty much.
Is
yeah.
That it?
Yeah, yeah. We, myself and John Lynn, who's the first act there, we have a fairly fine schedule worked out between the two of us. I swan in at 5 to 8.
So you want to no big musical instruments to set up or pieces?
No, God
like,
knows.
Like, out you go.
None of this divvying up the proceeds between the band and shifting all the gear out. You walk in, you might, you know, iron a shirt. You might.
Who's your favourite comedian?
Who's my favourite comedian? Depends on
who's your biggest influences.
I don't know anymore. I have favourite comedians. I like comedians. I love lads who I can't see how they do it. I can't see the strings, if you know what I mean, you know. And they don't use any sort of formula or anything like that. They're just, it's like Stuart Lee is brilliant, Richard Pryor for what he was doing.
He was genius, yeah.
And when you look at Richard Pryor and you look at, and when you don't realise, or it took me a second to realise, you go, that's the first time anybody said that. Whatever he's talking about there, it's the first time anybody said it in that way, you know. You know, Billy Connolly's obviously amazing. More the current crop.
They're great storytellers.
Oh, fantastic, yeah. Dara Breen, brilliant. Brilliant off the top of his head in particular. Tommy Tiernan is great. And then sometimes people maybe that people would not be as familiar with, the likes of Pajama Men are a great combo if you ever get to see them in Kilkenny, or Hans Teven, who is a Dutch comedian.
Always get watch him all the time.
He is one of the funniest things. Have you ever discovered someone in a dingy little dark bar somewhere, like a band or something, and then you suddenly go, God, these guys are
yes.
If they're not massive already,
they should be.
This guy is going to be absolutely massive. But this guy's has sold 20 million albums or something ridiculous in Holland, and I saw him in Edinburgh a couple of years ago and could not stop laughing.
What do you do to chill and relax when you're out of the...
I play indoor football.
Do you?
Badly.
Where?
Yes. In fact, I was asked this recently and I said I play indoor football badly, meaning that the football that was played was bad, i.e. by me.
Right.
And one of the lads read this, he was in the Sunday Times or something, and I've been abused for the past 5 or 6 Mondays by Tom McGivney. I'd like to say hello to Tom McGivney. I was referring to my own skill and not yours, Tom. But he kicks me every week now. Every week, because he thinks I'm having a go at him. I'm not having a go at him. I do that and I go to the cinema and I watch sport and all the rest. You know, and it's been fun recently. I've been on Fighting Talk, and it's a thing on BBC Radio 5 Live, and it's just about sport, and you can get to be all kind of nerdy and geeky about sport, so that's kind of fun.
You seem, Neil, to be very comfortable in your own skin.
I don't know how to answer that and go, no, I'm not.
Well, no, you seem to be. I mean, you seem to have handled. I mean, at the end of the day, you are in the public domain.
To a certain extent.
You've got quite a lot of strings to your bow. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you'd like to try?
I'd like to do more radio eventually. I'd like to do, you know, in a few years, maybe. Although I see friends of mine who do morning radio particularly, and I say, do you ever get used to it? And they go, no. And they have this glazed look in their eyes as if it just kills them. The hours just kill them.
And stuff, and they're up early to get in and prep and get on.
But they've moved, a friend of mine like that, Dermot Whelan, who now does Republic of Telly, we have the same agent, and he has moved to 4 o'clock, and he's a new man, you know. So I'd like to do radio, but maybe at 4 o'clock rather than 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd like to do documentaries. I'd like to do comedy documentaries.
Would you?
About history. That's what I'd like to do. And there may or may not be one in RTE in the autumn.
There may or may not be one.
Yes, about Vikings.
Vikings.
Yeah, so I'll come back to you and talk about that one if it happens. I'd like to do that.
Okay.
Because it's never been done really in this country before. I mean, we have documentaries, all right, but there's never been one which would be accurate, but with a bit of a laugh thrown into it as well, because so it wouldn't feel like learning as much, you know?
So you'd like to be a program maker?
No. Because that sounds far too...
Salivial.
Yes. And also, a friend of mine once said, who works in radio, he went, it's fine when you're on the radio. If you ever... And he was talking about himself. He said, if you ever start referring to yourself as a broadcaster, you're just a knob, right? You need to just take your head out of your arse and just be a DJ or just be whatever you are, you know?
I don't like DJ. I think DJ is a horrible...
I think of DJ as being, you know, hey, that was...
This is.
I don't really like DJ either.
Too much, and radio presenter is kind of too old.
Well, no, I think radio presenter is all right. What would you describe yourself as during this show now?
During this show?
Yeah.
And what happened next and where did you go after that?
No, I think there's much more skill to it than that.
Absolutely right, altogether. Neil, thank you so much for coming in. I've thoroughly enjoyed the past hour in your company. May we wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you very much.
Certainly you're somebody I'll be watching with close attention from now on. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the life and times of Neil Delamere. Somewhat.
Some of it.
Neil, thanks for that.